Yes, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant, and this is Now We're Talking. Percussionist Todd Bifford suffers from relentless curiosity and a complete fascination with the joy of sound. His passion and dedication have opened up many doors, resulting in frequent touring with a variety of musical projects. From 2007 to 2014, Todd was a member of Vancouver band Maria and the Shower, and currently he can be seen at the Stanley Theatre until July 9th in the Arts Club production of Million Dollar Quartet, and he's here in the studio with me now. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
You and I bumped into each other like a week or so ago after you were doing a performance of Million Dollar Quartet.
It's true. I was riding my bicycle home one evening, and you were on your way to accumulate your minimum required steps for the day.
That's exactly right. I'm usually very diligent to get those steps done early in the day, but I gigged, and I was running out of time. You and I are having a robust conversation, and I don't want to be a person who denies such a robust conversation by checking my phone, but I was worried about A, the time, and B, the lack of steps.
It's true.
So you were kind enough to join me.
I did accommodate
to get the rest of the steps, and you didn't make me feel weird about it.
You know, I can appreciate the discipline that you have to do that.
It's important for me. It really is. I take it very seriously, as you found out that night. But we ended up having like an hour-long conversation, both standing in the middle of a bike path intersection and then walking around getting those steps.
It's true.
And I realized this week we basically already had a conversation that was ready for this show. So why don't we have a conversation on
And here
show?
I am.
And here you are. You've come here.
Fresh,
you just had some pizza.
Fresh from my show. I literally finished the show this afternoon, got on my bike, wandered over to your house, and came out to UBC.
Here we go. I was optimistic you'd have a matinee today, and it would time out just right, and here we are. There's so much we can talk about today, but I guess let's kind of break down the history of you playing with bands. That's what I'm curious about. When you were a kid, were you in bands, or did you go to school for music and do that later in life?
I have a very, what I would describe as non-standard history when it comes to evolution as a musician, that I did not play with bands.
Neither did
as a kid. Yeah. My first band was Maria and the Shower.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I was already, what was I, like 27 years old or something.
Wow.
So I learned music just through high school music classes, basically. And in that context, especially in North America, you're learning jazz music. And I definitely did not understand the history of the music. That was never part of the education in high school. It was more just about the technical aspects.
Right.
And I missed out a lot on the purpose behind that music. Hmm. But I did have a relatively easy time picking up the technique. So I developed skill as a musician without having any purpose behind it. And I loved music. I could tell that it was something that had an important effect on me, and I wanted that to be part of my life. But I didn't have the desire to be a troublemaker or get into bands or be just a resistance fighter at that young age. I was kind of just following the script.
Yeah.
The one thing I did do, which was an important part of that early evolution, though, I think I was 16, I joined a Scottish bagpipe band.
That's a band. I mean, did it have a name?
Well, we were just the Kelowna Legion Pipe Band. But
that's a band, man.
I guess I was in a band, but it was not a band of my peers.
It wasn't a garage band.
Definitely not. And I was playing a marching snare drum and walking around with old surly Scottish men and drinking whiskey out of a flask on parades and stuff like that. So
they were drinking out of the flask, or you also drank?
We all did. We all
shared. So you were included all the way.
Yeah,
that's cool.
I guess I was in the band, so to speak. It was a real band because we went on tour. I guess, I was touring when I was 16, you could say, because we would travel around in cars and vans. But we went to Scotland. We did lots of shows. I did lots of gigs. I started gigging when I was 16 as a member of a bagpipe band. Some of my favorite memories from, this is in Kelowna where I grew up, we would do a winter like fundraising drive to try and raise money for the food bank. We would do a pub crawl where we would go around to pubs and play a set. You would call it a set, which is only like four or five tunes in sequence. And volunteer friends of the band would be walking around with buckets, and people would throw their coins or small dollars, and then we'd raise thousands of dollars on a night. And these are playing in bars all over the town, all over Kelowna. So that was fun.
How did you join that band? How did you get involved with them?
Another kid was in the band that I went to school with, and his dad lured me in. He had heard that I was some
that
kind
never
of,
you know, sounds good when a dad lures a child
he
into
lured
something.
Me.
In this case, it turned out fine.
He would come to my soccer practice and just lurk about on the sidelines
with
when
the
it was
flask.
Over. And
he'd be like,
he'd be chatting up. He'd be chatting me up. He's like, hey, so you like drums, don't you? I'm like, yeah, I play drums. He's like, well, you ought to come and try this band. It's real fun. It's real fun. And he basically wooed me into the band. It took a couple months.
The luring, the wooing, the flask. Yeah. Like, this story so easily could have turned out another way. No, I'm so glad it did.
It was great. I'm so happy I met that guy. Don King was his name, not the same Don King that went on to promote
the
boxing.
The Kelowna Don King.
This is the Kelowna Don King. Yeah.
And are you ever in touch with these guys anymore when you go back to Kelowna?
No.
I wonder if they still play.
Well, the band, the affiliation of that band with the Legion ended a long time ago. And
okay.
One thing I can say about pipe bands, and this is true everywhere in the world, is that they often don't get along very well and ultimately break up and separate, and then all the drummers will get pissed off at all the pipers and they'll all leave and go join another band somewhere else, and this was always the case.
Is that the major fractions between the drummers and the pipers?
That's part of it, but then there's also bands don't like each other, kind of, and these rivalries develop, and then when one person infiltrates another band and he'll draw all his friends from that band to the other band, and it's really silly. Honestly, the competitive nature of it I didn't like. So
right.
The primary function of a bagpipe band is to go into competition where you're judged.
Right. It's almost like a sport.
It's like a sport. Also, in high school music program, we went to jazz festivals where we were adjudicated.
Mm.
And so we're trying to perform at our highest level and get some kind of, respect from an adjudicator about it. And so my early music experiences were all about being judged in music. And to me,
it was like a
music,
beauty competition.
Well, it
or
became
something.
A competitive thing. Music was a competitive thing. And what inspired me or drove me to succeed was to be better than the next guy. And it took me a long time to realize that that's not the primary function of music. But I was young and impressionable, and that's how I learned what music was about.
And these drunk Scotsmen were telling you that's the way that it was.
Well, you wouldn't. They had some unkind things to say about opposition bands. Like, it was really nasty.
Cutthroat.
It was very cutthroat. And then about the judges, too, because remember, there are judges now, so it gets political. Well, that judge, they could remember 10 years ago that judge gave them a poor mark on their ensemble playing at whatever Highland Games event it was. And so all of these things I found conflicting, because I knew music. I wanted to be involved in music, but the competitive aspect of it I didn't get. The history of the jazz music I was playing, I didn't get. No one explained those things to me. It took time for all of that to gel. And so it wasn't until I was 23 that I gave up on my career and as a bureaucrat and went back to school at Humber College in Toronto. And I got a real education in not just technique, but also purpose and why you play music. And
intention.
There was the competitive thing there too, I suppose, because when you get a bunch of super hyped up, talented 18-year-old musicians together in a room, they want to prove themselves to each other. But there were small groups of us who weren't so competitive. And we found a home there and we evolved as people. And then from there, I just started touring, basically. And playing real shows with real musicians and understanding what it meant to perform and why we perform. So that all sort of coalesced, and at this point now I'm very comfortable understanding that, and I wish somebody had explained that to me earlier, but it was a long and roundabout way to get at where I am today, but sometimes that's the course of your life, and that's fine.
For sure, it gives you that contrast and that awareness. What has it been like subsequently going out into the world, collaborating with musicians? Have you still detected pockets of competition, or do you feel that as you move along, you sense that people are more collaborative and generous in their spirit?
I guess it's the case that I only associate myself now with people who are generous and collaborative.
Because you're conscious of that?
Yeah. I don't remember who told me this. It was some musician in some band. He was explaining about how when a band is still early or in their infancy, or when musicians are not mature enough, they compare themselves to other musicians, and they might have unkind things to say about other musicians because it helps prop them up.
Mm.
But when you're an established musician and you just feel good about what you're doing, you don't do that anymore.
There's no reason to do it.
You don't,
there's no value in doing it.
You don't have to compare yourself to anyone anymore.
Right.
You're just comfortable doing what you do, and you're happy that other people do what they do.
Yeah.
And
it is a big relief to come out the other side of that, because from my experience doing different things, music, acting, whatever, all areas of life, not just the arts, I think when you're young, it feels like, oh man, if it's this cutthroat and competitive at this stage, you extrapolate that it will get worse and worse as you move into the world. But my experience has certainly been just like you say, once you get over that hurdle, generally, people that are good at what they do and confident about what they do don't really feel the need to tear each other down. So it actually becomes a more inviting space. Like, for example, you're doing this arts club show. Mm-hmm. And I know that was my experience at the arts club, meeting all these actors and musicians who were so great at what they did. And they're such great people, such kind, generous people also. And it's just like, oh, wow, how cool to get mm-hmm. through to the other side and do professional theater, something I never thought I'd get the chance to do. And to realize that people here are quite grateful for what they have because they've been through whatever it took to get to that place.
Yeah, and I definitely feel more grateful and appreciative of the opportunity to get up and play to a really great house every night and to have all the support of that network behind me. I think when I first started doing musical theater, I didn't appreciate that as much. Mm-hmm. I still thought of it as I have to prove myself every night. I have to go out and achieve something. Whereas now I look back on each experience, like the one I had today, and I think this was such a privilege for me to do this. It might not happen again. You know, I might not continue to get these really great opportunities to play in these situations. And I'm actually okay with that. I feel that if you put that pressure on you to always have to achieve that, it does a couple of things. But one of them is it doesn't allow you to really live in that moment and give mm-hmm. the best performance that you can. So as an artist, for me, the most important thing is really living in that moment and doing the best I can and accepting that it might be the last moment, or if it is, that's okay. That's not the point. The point is just to extract every ounce of emotion and energy and, for me, sound that I can in that given moment. And that's it.
What was it that caused you to pick up the drums? Like, I'm assuming that when you were a kid, like we all do, you notice music, you had your experience of responding to it. Do you have a conscious memory of what attracted you to percussion as opposed to singing or playing tonal instruments?
Yes. Specifically, it's the sound, the type of sound that a snare drum makes, basically. A snare drum, to me, is a voice that just speaks so clearly to me. Hmm. I was, I think, in grade 4, the first time I experienced this sound. You know, you hear it all the time in music, in recorded music. Everyone knows the sound of the backbeat in a song. But not everyone understands that that's a snare drum that makes that sound. And I was definitely one of those kids. I didn't really understand until I went to a party at my soccer coach's house at the end of the soccer season. It would have been probably a month like this. This is May, it would have been, or June. Or June. It would be the end of the soccer season, June in Kelowna, a pool party at the coach's house. And at some point, I was lured by this sound because he had a drum set in his basement. Now everybody's partying at the pool, and I could hear this sound, and I guess it was his brother or somebody was playing on this drum set. And I just peeked in the room, and I saw this thing, and I heard this thing, and my brain just started to just come alive. Wow, this is amazing. It was the first time I heard a drum live, I think, and the first time I understood or associated the sound with the visual thing.
Right.
It was many years later that I actually got my first drum set, but that first moment was pretty important for me in terms of understanding what it was that inspired me to want to play drums specifically. And now I've gone on to play all sorts of other percussion, and I'm equally inspired by all sorts of things. But to me, that sound of a snare drum, just that crack, I still love it. I mean, it's my favorite show. My favorite songs in the show I'm doing now are the Johnny Cash songs, to be honest. And it's not because they're complicated musically. It's because this, that relentless groove with the backbeat on the snare, you know, we call it a train groove. Is how drummers
describe it. Is it shuffling or what's happening on there?
Well, it can be both. The train groove can shuffle or it can be more straight. It depends on the song. So the Folsom Prison Blues song, for example, which is the first one that comes up in the show, we play it as a slight shuffle. So the groove it's got a backbeat, but I play the snare drum in a subtle way behind the backbeat to create the shuffle feel. And it's just bass drum and snare drum. It's one of the most simple things you can do, but you can mine the depth of those instruments to create an emotional feeling if you know how to do that. So that song and finding the right tempo and keeping it super steady allows the support that makes the whole song shine. And the audience comes alive when they hear that song because they know that song. But what they don't know is about all of the simple things that go into making that thing feel good. And it's taken me 25 years to be able to do it with that kind of conviction.
And what's it like to have a relationship with an instrument which, as you say, has already lasted a quarter of a century, and you're going to continue to go through life, and the relationship is going to continue to evolve? I think that's one thing that maybe non-players don't consider, is that the learning never ends. The experience of your relationship is always in flux, like your relationship with anything. What's that like for you to project into the future and think about your relationship with drumming?
I think about that, and I realize for me, it's about pursuing the simplicity of the thing. Hmm. I don't think that's the case for every artist. Each artist has to find their own evolutionary progression. But for me, it's about understanding in a more simple way the things that I've been doing, getting rid of all the flash and getting rid of all the extraneous things and just focusing at the heart of the matter, which is really, it still comes down to that sound of the snare drum. Hmm. I'm still just trying to learn how to hit that backbeat so sweetly that not only does it sound good, but it feels good. And that takes a lifetime of study. I also teach a little bit. So I don't have a lot of drum students because I'm quite busy in my performance career. But I have a handful of students, and it's very enlightening for me to have conversations with them and to try and see how they perceive their instrument, and also for them to share with me their own perceptions. And that gives me a wider understanding of some of the things that I've struggled to understand. And then it also helps me to get some wider context into their own lives, because these people are not professional musicians for the most part. I have a few students who are professional drummers, but for the most part, they're just amateur musicians who love drums, and sometimes for the same reason that I love drums. It could just be the sound. But for many of them, it's a distraction from their everyday life. And when they bring their own understanding or thoughts from their everyday life into the drum lesson, that can be very enlightening as well, because it helps me to understand what let's call them the average person, or what people more widely, how they perceive things. And I can use that information to start to connect with people generally, and not just about connecting with musicians. That's another thing that has evolved as I've evolved as a musician, is the understanding that my main function is not necessarily to communicate with the other musicians on stage. It's to communicate with the audience, and their perceptions are not the same. And what they hear is not the same. I mean, physically they're hearing the same thing, but they don't interpret it in the same way. So you need to be able to put yourself in their shoes, hear things from what their ears hear. And if you can do that, then you can really convey a message to them.
Yeah. Let's talk about Maria and the Shower. I'm interested to know what caused you to start your first band after having gone to school for music at Humber, having been in the Scottish band with the curmudgeonly Scots.
Yeah.
What caused you to put that together? Did you have a sense of what that undertaking would be?
No. And I think that the best things
that was
in life,
a certain very resounding no.
Well, very clearly. And I think the best things in life are things that happen spontaneously, where you allow the experience to happen and you just fulfill your part in that, but you don't try to push it too hard. And for the first many years of my band's existence, it was all about that. We were following whichever way the wind took us. We didn't try to push our own agenda. And that created a very organic origin for the band, whereby the music, the art itself, was very honest. Not like something that might be contrived from the beginning just to be a marketing ploy or to take a particular song and try to sell it. It was a very different approach, which meant that we were a band first and foremost. We were for people who wanted to create that music together because that's what we loved to do, not because we wanted to have careers as a musician, not right. because we were trying to sell a song.
You weren't worried about its commercial potential. You were worried about its artistic potential.
Exactly.
Maybe not worried. You were interested is a better
Well,
word.
You know, and to
Maybe
be
you were
honest,
worried. I don't know.
Later on, the let's call it the financial potential of the band, did become something that we got concerned about, because as we got older as individuals and our own financial priorities changed,
right,
we did start to focus a little bit on how to make money as a band. And
moving beyond just the doing a show every once in a while in your home market and hoping people will pay X amount of dollars at the door, but thinking about getting presented professionally.
Yes, and part of that had to do with the fact that we were being offered contracts for large sums of money. So suddenly there's an obligation there, a professional obligation, to deliver a specific kind of show that,
right,
that contracting individual or festival wanted to hear.
Right.
And that started to conflict with our entire reason for being as a band, which was to just be creative.
Mm.
And there was nothing more complicated than that. And so when our creative freedom was stymied in a way by an expectation, that was the beginning of the end of the band. But I don't think that was unfortunate. I think that's the nature of how these things function, because it was a 10-year trajectory. I joined the band in its third year of existence, and the band ended after 10 years. And I think 10 years is not an unusual life cycle for an existence like that. A creative idea goes through phases. And at the end, it wasn't tenuous anymore. We all had different creative ideas, and we couldn't find common ground to allow that to continue. So that was the end of the band. But the origins of the band, which is what your question was not something that was contrived, or we didn't, you know, form a focus group and say, oh, what kind of product can we create to sell to the masses?
Although now that you mention that, as we're getting older and thinking about commercial viability, that's an amazing idea. We should an episode of the show where we conduct a focus group, discuss different ideas for making it huge.
Hey, not only that, I've given thought to what would be the best way to build a band. You need other people rather than musicians. I would actually have a band that would include like a web designer or a person who's really good,
right,
at design.
Treat it like an organization.
It's got to be a whole organization. And this designer person is part of the creative entity of the band. Why is the designer not part of,
right,
the whole face?
Don't limit
of the
it
band.
To the musicians. Have an organization, a small business basically, where everybody's got an equal stake. So let's talk this through, because this could be brilliant. Either we're going to do it, although I'm kind of concerned if we're going to do this and have this conversation. Not only are you sharing your ideas with me, but with the world at large. And
somebody out there
might be very industrious and say, these guys are still stuck in the studio. We can get started right now, well, and they'll have a head start.
I have to be honest, though. I think this already happens. It's just that the face of the band, those three or four people, they're just, that's how the marketing people in the band choose to portray the band. It's just easier. You have to decide how you're going to sell that idea. And to sell a huge number of people involved in many facets is not easy. But to sell just one face, maybe you have one like good-looking guy who's the lead singer. This is how these things get started, right? I mean, U2 is a whole organization. The Rolling Stones is a whole organization. There's all kinds of people involved in making that happen. But you don't see those other people because it's too cumbersome. It's too complicated to try and sell that. People just want to bite onto a very simple idea. They want a little nugget. You can't give them too much.
Yeah. Well, it's like you go into a store, you go to the retail area of that store. You don't necessarily do a tour of the manufacturing plant,
right,
or the corporate head office.
It's
you
true.
Go into the store, you buy your product, which is on the rack, and you
it's
leave.
It's true. I never got to tell you, though, how I got into the band.
Please.
It was a spontaneous meeting at this place on Main Street called Café Montmartre, which doesn't exist anymore. But this was a very important place for our band in the early days, because we ended up finding a weekly gig there. But Martin and Jack, the two front men for the band, they showed up while I was playing another gig with another band that night. And in true Maria in the Shower fashion, these two guys who had been calling themselves Marie in the Shower, they were confused. They thought they'd booked that night, and they showed up to play a gig, and they had told a bunch of people they're playing.
Oh,
they got
dear.
There and they realized, oh, you know, we got the date wrong. And so our band I was a sideman in this other kind of Irish folk band, which never went anywhere. But anyway, the leader of that band talked to these guys, and he came back to our table and said, okay, these guys are going to play a few songs because they've misbooked a night, and they want to play a couple songs. They're just going to play a couple songs. So these two guys went up there, and I had never met them, and I enjoyed what they were doing. They played a version of St. James Infirmary Blues that made my spine tingle, and it was a very powerful experience. And so I asked them if I could join them on stage, and I did. And we played the next three or four numbers together. And some of them were complex because they had very unusual arrangements, and I was just trying to fly by the seat of my pants. Thankfully, I have a strong background in improvised music, which is what I focused on in Toronto. So I was very able to hang on as they negotiated these very unusual musical arrangements. And they were digging what I was doing, and I was digging what they were doing. So we just said, hey, let's do this again next week. And without any rehearsal, without really any further discussion, we just started to book a weekly show at Café Montmartre, which became like our house gig.
As a trio.
As a trio for the first, only the first month. And then their bass, the bass player, Brendan, he had been out of town for that first month, and he had done a couple gigs with him before. He was a longtime friend of Martin because they both grew up in Invermere. And so when Brendan got back to town, because he was going to Emily Carr, he was studying photography. When he came back in September, he just started joining us too. And I only met him at a gig one night. He just showed up. And so spontaneously on stage, without any rehearsing, Martin would just present a bunch of material and we would kind of follow along with what he was doing. We didn't have rehearsals. We actually didn't rehearse probably for the first 6 months of that band's existence. We didn't have a single rehearsal. We just played every week for Pass the Hat. It was a Pass the Hat gig.
It was kind of an exciting way to form a musical bond with each other where you're just thrown into the water and you tread water together. Like, sure. The learning happens a lot faster that way, right?
Definitely. Not just the musical learning, but also the learning of how to react and respond to each other.
Yeah.
How to understand the tendencies of each other and gel as a group. And that carried us through a number of years because we had this strength that most bands did not have. And it was due to that evolution of our sound. We also, when we did start to rehearse later on, we were not a good rehearsal band. Rehearsing was not one of our strengths. And our rehearsals comprised of just acoustic in the kitchen or living room at somebody's house, without even our proper instruments or full instruments. I very rarely had a drum set at a rehearsal. Normally I had a tambourine, that's all I did. And we didn't have a PA, and we didn't amplify, we didn't do anything like that. But we would learn those skills about working through a PA and sounding good on stage on a gig. And thankfully we had lots of small gigs where it didn't matter and we could learn things. But quickly it developed, and within 2 years, we were touring because we had ambitions to reach more audiences and we wanted more shows. So within 2 or 3 years, we were definitely a touring band where we were playing between 60 and 75 shows a year, and that grew to 100 shows a year for a number of years. And it was a great learning experience, but we didn't make a ton of money. It was never about money. So thankfully, that didn't spoil us too early and that we didn't go for the money, so to speak.
Yeah.
But when I think about getting involved in a band again and the financial considerations, the idea of having to make money is definitely something that needs to be taken into account. But at the same time, it can spoil really great creative ideas.
Especially when you've had the experience, as you have and as I also have had, where you've kind of broken through to a certain level where there are contracts, there are... We spoke recently about that experience of being flown to do a gig and being put up in a hotel room, maybe even getting your own hotel room. Like, these are no small feats. If you pull the average musician, they may have not even had that experience. You get to that level and you realize even under these circumstances, you know, if you've got a family or you've got other considerations, even if you're operating at a pretty successful level, yeah, it's hard to, you know, I always felt like for me in my situation with my original music, it's like, you know, make a good salary for a couple of years, but try to do that for 40 years when you're hustling, you know. So at some point there is, I imagine, some relief in also, I don't know, for me getting off the road, you enjoy being on the road. Is that something you miss about being in the original band?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
It's an adventure.
I liked all the crazy aspect of that lifestyle. And I was able to separate myself from the craziest parts of it too.
Can you tell us the craziest parts? Well, or is it too controversial?
You know, no, it's not really controversial. It's the same cliches that you've heard. Those sorts of stories of bands on the road and
throwing TVs out the windows.
Well, not so much that. Bands today are are more responsible, but the idea of not knowing really where you're going to sleep, let's just take that as a basic example. Sure. You're playing a show and at the end of the night, you're like, well, we don't know where to go and it's 2 a.m. in a place we've never been. And now we're going to hang out with these people and have some fun and interesting experiences until 5 a.m. And then you realize, oh, we got to drive 8 more hours to the next town and we haven't slept. So
who's driving?
Well, I know who's driving. It's me.
Was it always you?
It's always me. Well, because I didn't need much sleep. I could function on 3 or 4 hours sleep. And the other guys, yeah. Well, Jack was pretty road hardy too. But Martin, forget it. That guy needed a lot of rest. He would sleep all day. Oh, yeah. We had what we call his hypnopompic state, which is basically from whenever he sort of stumbles out of his bed until the gig starts. So like for 14 hours, he's in this sort of delirious state of not knowing really where he is and not knowing if he needs to eat or not eat or sleep or not sleep, or he's just confused.
Until the adrenaline kicks in on stage and he comes alive.
As soon as the band kicks in, he's totally there. He was always able to deliver a great show, but life on the road for him was tough because he was just a little bit more fragile physically. Like he, and that's not a knock on him, and he accepts that too. He had a lower constitution.
Yeah.
Whereas Jack could go for 2 days without sleeping and he'd be smoking all night and still sing, and it didn't affect him. He was just a lot hardier. And me, I could function without sleep, so I would do all the driving. We had a good relationship in that respect. We each played to our own strengths, and it worked. It was fun. I miss that, and I also miss the other touring. I don't want people to think that that's the only thing I've done. I've done a lot of other tours, sometimes on shows where there's a great tour manager and I get my own hotel room, and sometimes on tours where I don't get paid a lot and I sleep on the floor. I like all of those situations because I find that the experiences I can't get anywhere else. I like having a diversified life, and
yeah,
it's great. The toughest thing is trying to balance that with being a parent, to be honest. When you have children and you want to go away and experience these things, the bottom line, the financial bottom line, becomes a reality that you can't just ignore. So that was one thing that separated me from the other guys in Marie in the Shower at the time, because I had kids at a relatively young age. In the later years of the band, Jack also had kids. So that was helpful in some respects because there was more of an understanding of those responsibilities within the band. But it still made it hard. And we were making more money at that point anyway, so it was probably easier for Jack. But it definitely takes its toll. And so that's why I've stopped, for the most part, the touring lifestyle. Now I will only tour if somebody's going to pay me pretty good money.
Yeah.
And it's not because I don't want to be touring. I would love to be touring. It's just because I have other responsibilities that I need to put first. So
yeah. You need to have that framework in place as you go through a selection process of how you're going to spend your time, which is a commodity, as you're scheduling your year.
Plus, I've already had lots of great tour experience. It's not like I feel like I need to go out there and learn this stuff or experience it for the first time. I've kind of done it, and I enjoy it, and I recommend anyone who wants to work as a musician should live through that. You need to play more than 100 gigs a year.
Yeah.
You need to do that for a number of years. You need to know what that feels like. These are experiences you cannot get in music school. You just won't understand until you go out there and do it. I think that when I see most bands today who will play 5 to 10 shows a year and they consider themselves to be a band, that's the contemporary way, given that people now are more focused on marketing themselves on the internet.
Reserving their job and playing shows strategically.
Exactly. But it's...
But you get better by doing things.
There used
like
to be a lot more gig opportunities, I think, for bands. Now there were fewer bands because the costs of entry into the market were different. Nowadays, you can record an album for almost nothing. You can take it on the road. You can start to promote yourself. In the 80s and into the early 90s, you still needed to go into a recording studio, and you couldn't afford that if you weren't on a label. You needed to have some kind of support. So that right away cut the number of bands you're competing with down by 90%. But today, you can go out there and do it on your own initiative at very little cost. So there are so many bands out there, which means that there are fewer gigs for the bands that do exist. So most bands stay home. They just don't play that many shows. Yeah. Marie in the Shower had a different mentality about that. We went out there and played shows because that's what we were good at.
Yeah.
That was our strength. We didn't want to market ourselves on the internet. I mean, we tried, but we were never good at that. We just wanted to go out and play shows. And so that's what we did. And that's still my favorite thing.
With that in mind, you were suggesting earlier before we started the show that you have a bold, audacious notion to potentially form the first modern day band without a website or even web presence across the board. I think Let's make it all encompassing, not just a website, you know, but nothing.
Well, they say what's old is new again.
Yeah. So I was saying it could be a huge hit because people will find out about this. It will blow their minds because maybe, you know, there's a certain demographic that has never known a world without the internet. Right. And it will create such a buzz, ironically, on the internet that it will lead to people going off the internet and coming to see this theoretical band. Could I be in this band potentially?
Sure.
I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm intrigued by this. And I love not being on the internet, so I think I'm a good candidate for it.
The internet tires me out. It's exhausting. I would rather spend my time being creative than trying to...
It's a vortex, right? We've talked about this before. That was one of the things we talked about in that conversation we had a week or two ago, where, of course, there's value in it, but it's about finding the moderation for me on a personal level and as well with things like this show. You know, like today I made sure I promoted the show on Instagram with a picture with the logo on top of it. But yeah, I'm more interested in doing the actual thing than I am getting bogged down in that. And from my experience promoting my own original band in the past, you know, I was 90% of what we did in the band was putting ourselves out there and creating opportunity. And the remaining 10% was writing and performing songs. And I stand by that experience because it gave us an incredible experience within that 10%. But yeah, 90% of the time was all about typing.
Yeah.
And if there's a way, that's why I enjoyed busking when I first started playing music. I was like, what's the opportunity, like you say, to not just get in a band and play a couple shows a year, but I want to get better at the thing. To get better at the thing, I want to do the thing. Mm. It's like you talk about how you guys kind of gelled in Maria in the Shower. I love that because I know for me, whether it's with songwriting or rehearsing or anything like that, man, there's an energy shift when there's an audience. Big time. To the extent that there's even been times when I've been like doing gigs, maybe like a wedding or something, I'm supposed to be playing some cover music for a cocktail hour, and I'll just start, you know, people are like focused on each other, they're not consciously tuned into what I'm doing. I'll just start writing a song because it feels so rapid, so quick to be doing it in that setting rather than like in my bedroom kicking back with an acoustic guitar. There's something about being in that setting that's
The immediacy.
Yeah, because it's happening now. It's like, if I fail, I'm going to quickly make an adjustment. Yeah. Everything's going to move really quickly. And if I have those moments where I'm like, that fits, it's a rush. It's a real rush.
Well, these are some of the things that initially attracted me to pursue music. And the type of music that I wanted to play was improvised music. So when I say improvised music, generally that comes from either a classical music, like classical new music background, or from a jazz music background. And improvised music can involve all kinds of influences and sounds and instruments and people with creative ideas coming together to make something spontaneous. And that's the kind of music that I still to this day would love to perform. I had to change the nature of my entire artistic raison d'être just because I can't make money playing improvised music. It's one of the least lucrative musical forms. And partly that's understood because it's also something that is fundamentally, it seems to me, a music that exists for the musician and not for the listener. And this was a disconnect that I tried to reconcile in the nature of my performances when I was younger in Toronto, and that would be to use improvised music as a forum to connect with people through more direct means of audience interaction. Normally, an improvised music concert, two or three musicians get up on stage, they put their head down, they don't really acknowledge the audience, they get into their own little world, and 45 minutes later, they just kind of stop and people politely applaud. But there's not been a strong connection between what they're doing and what the audience is hearing. That lack of audience interaction bothered me somewhat. Mm. So I would create little things. Even it can be something simple as having an audience member choose how the evolution of the improvisation goes or participate in the performance. I didn't do a lot of this stuff because I was pretty young and it was experimental, but at the performances I did present in Toronto, this is what I did because I didn't want to create music that didn't relate to whoever was listening to it.
Yeah.
And so in Marie in the Shower, I found that I was able to kind of try and balance those two things because people were really into what we were doing. It was inspiring music, but it was also spontaneous in that we didn't rehearse. I loved that aspect of it. In other things that I do, it's the opposite of that. For example, the theater show I'm doing now. It's so well rehearsed that we could basically play the thing with blindfolds on, with probably without even hearing each other. We could nail it down. But, and this is something I've learned from theater, from actors and watching them work, the act of getting so deeply into something, once you cross a certain threshold into it, you can actually feel the spontaneity of it again. You learn to exhibit and portray the spontaneous nature of something after you've internalized it so deeply. And that's something that I don't think a lot of musicians get an experience to do because you have to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. Doing the show that I'm doing now 8 times a week, and in rehearsal, we did, 11 and a half hour rehearsals over the course of a week. And before that, 8 hours a day for 2 weeks. It's so much a part of our system that we are able to express it with that spontaneous feeling. Whereas a lot of bands who play 2 to 10 gigs a year and call themselves a band, there's no chance that they're going to be able to do that. So it lacks that energy and mystique that comes from a truly improvised place. So I'm now really, as an artist, trying to retain that same feeling and that same flavor in every performance that I do because I put a lot of preparation into what I do, even if it's one gig with one person for the CD release show. I will internalize everything so that when it comes time to perform it, it feels like it's spontaneous. It has that spontaneous energy about it. And that's important to me because that's what people connect with and that's what they can't get on a recording or on the internet or on YouTube. You can't just try and give them something that they can get somewhere else. You have to give them something special.
And in a way, it has even more currency now when people can become lost inside those digital experiences to have a human connection with live music. Not only is it still relevant, but it's probably more relevant than ever. More potent than ever, I should think.
Well, the human aspect of communication that has been lost in our society through more use of phones, for example, and internet. I find this really sad. And it's my responsibility as an artist to try and use this forum that I have and this communication that I have to try and help people see through that. It's not necessarily the case that the internet has to be bad or that using your phone has to be bad, but if you allow it to overwhelm your life and to detract from your own humanness and the uniqueness that makes you a human and able to communicate with others, if you let that fall by the wayside, then you're really missing out on one of the primary reasons that we're here. So it bothers me when I see a bunch of people at a concert just rubbing their phone.
I was going to say, imagine in the theater context, as opposed to a music show or concert, you expect most of the audience members at the Stanley Theater not to be checking their phones.
Definitely.
And so you 8 times a week, you're in a nice room. It's a nice theater, and I'm sure with nice large crowds, and their eyeballs are just fixed on that stage.
It's true.
And that must be nice to have that experience 8 times a week and to live inside of that.
But even in Marie in the Shower, we were able to inspire that type of feeling. Yeah. People were there because they wanted to see us.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the case that they were losing interest in checking their phone. If on the rare occasion a phone came out, it was because they wanted to be like, I can't believe I'm seeing this. I'm going to film it and put it up on YouTube later. And so many times we had to get frustrated by that because the sound quality was so bad and there's this thing and the lighting wasn't good.
Right.
I mean, one thing that we always wanted in Marie in the Shower was the ability to control the sound and the lights more because we always wanted to present a more complete performance, a theatrical performance.
Yeah.
And we did achieve that in certain ways. But we also could not possibly ever match something like what I'm doing at the Arts Club because literally at the Arts Club, we had a whole week where there were 5 tech people tweaking things just to get this show looking so good.
Yeah.
Right down to, I'm not even counting the wardrobe people actually, 7 people if you count the wardrobe people. I mean, they're tweaking our hair and our costumes. They would change my shirt out
every
other time.
Lighting and gels and focusing and in terms of sound, hopefully, like the minutiae, all the details, and going cue to cue to cue, every moment in the show is accounted for, and it's gone through like with a fine tooth comb.
And this is what what you experience when you go to see a band play for a $150 concert at
yes.
GM Place.
Exactly.
Or
it's a theatrical production. And when you've done theater and professional theater, you realize, oh, that's what this is. This is a very large scale, one night only in this particular town theater presentation where this moment where the lead singer is now going to walk down the thrusts of the front of the stage and have a moment where they make a joke with an audience member. This stuff has been rehearsed.
It's scripted.
And hopefully, like we're also saying about actors or performers, there's, you know, I remember this experience from busking, from seeing street performers who put on very impressive circle shows. Usually they're jugglers and they're comedians, basically. And I would go to see them. I've seen that guy. I'll watch him again. And I realize, oh, the joke where he says he's going to do it slower for the Americans in the audience. I've seen that joke before. Yeah. And you realize, oh, it's a script. And I think I was initially disappointed by that, but I've come to realize, well, the skill is to find the things that work, but to deliver them with presence. And I think that for musicians, from my experience originally coming from theater, I was always intrigued when music, just as much as acting, is a performance on a stage for an audience. It's really an art that is lost on a lot of musicians, and when you do see it, yeah, it's like they've taken the time to think about what would make this a good show for the audience member. What a concept.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that was not well explained in the music school that I went to, or any music school for that matter.
So or even acknowledged.
And I had questions about that. I remember struggling with that when I was in music school. I was like trying to, because I wanted to know the purpose behind what I was doing. I wanted to understand why I did it.
Yeah, it's like underneath all of the details is human connection. You know what I mean? It's like there's this thing called music. These are the instruments, blah, blah, blah. And I guess people are allowed to, they enjoy music for whatever reason it is. But I think fundamentally, going back to something you're saying earlier, I think that experience you had of hearing that drum kit at the pool party, what that was like for you as a boy, and what it's like for people when they put the phone away and their eyes are glued on the stage, is it's an experience of human connection that is transcendent because of the beauty and the majesty of music.
Exactly.
The look on your face. Another surefire moment when you wholeheartedly agreed. That was a nice moment. I guess, yeah, we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to ask you, just coming fast forwarding back to the present moment, you're doing this arts club show, but as you think about projects that you want to do moving forward, touring, studio work, how do you navigate balancing between, as you said on your website, I was reading something where you said you try to balance your time between commercially viable work and music that is purely creative. So what is that like for you right now to try to strike that balance?
Well, I'm in a lucky place, given that I have a certain reputation and network of people that contact me to do theater specifically. So I usually have 1, 2, sometimes 3 theater shows a year that helps fill out my calendar and puts
nice foundation to build on.
It's really great.
Yeah.
So I already have another show booked for the fall.
Cool.
And those things allow me to be centered, I guess, and have something in my schedule. And then I can pick and choose between other things that I do. I've also gotten away from feeling that I need to promote myself or hustle for gigs. I just don't do it anymore. And that's not because I recommend to people that you do that. It's because I've done enough of that it's sort of tired me out, and I don't need to do it because I get all the gigs I need. I can still turn down gigs now because I have enough interest in here in Vancouver specifically about me and what I'm doing. So
it's nice that the work that you did when you were going through that necessary stage of exhaustively putting yourself out there has now resulted in a situation where your work speaks for itself.
Yes, and I also accept that it could all end. You know, there is no certainty in this business, just like in other businesses as well, but definitely as an artistic pursuit. And I'm more at ease with that than I was in the past. In the past, I had that hunger to want to keep playing all the time and push and push and push, but I've done so many of those things and experienced those things that at this point, not to say that I'm complacent, but I feel more choosy about what I want to do. And I feel there's a new space evolving in my life to pursue things that are coming back to my origins as an artist, and that is in the improvised world. So just playing spontaneous kinds of things with people where there is no goal of making money. That's really what I want to be doing more now. So I will be focusing on those things moving forward, and I can balance it off because I have some really great theater contracts that help me pay the bills. So
it's funny you say that, because a friend of mine, Eric, who's been on this show previously, we were having a conversation a week or two ago, and I was telling him about how busy I've been recently doing some cover music gigs and stuff like that. And you know, he's an actor, but he's also a very enthusiastic singer, but he's never really pursued music as a thing. His focus has been on acting, but he's been around it as an actor. And he's so hungry for jamming and exploring music. We live in the same building. He's like, you got to get out the guitar and we got to jam and we'll get other people involved and it'll be great. And I kind of, with a sense of humor, was kind of explaining how, you know, it's funny from my experience, the more I've moved along to different degrees of a professional stature and had colleagues that make a living playing music, I would say that the longer somebody's been playing music, the more professional they are, the less inclined they are to jam. And this was kind of heartbreaking for him to hear, because for the layperson, if you have the ability to do that thing so well, that would make jamming so much more fun than when you're trying to figure out how to play the guitar or sing or play the drums. It's counterintuitive. Why would you not jam when you've got the ability to jam? And so that night I kind of texted a couple of friends who have played music with profession, like, hey man, when's the last time you jammed? And just realizing it really is easy. I think largely when people have other competing interests in their lives, to kind of allow that curiosity and creativity, like making time for it, to fall by the wayside. I know for me, less so with jamming, for me maybe with songwriting, but like trying to protect some time in the week to exercise that muscle, because it's so easy for it to slip away.
Well, that's why I've recently started to take to singing more and playing the piano, which are not things I would do professionally.
Yeah.
But they're still creative outlets.
Oh, yeah.
And it helps me understand better what my role is in a band by learning right. And appreciating more what the vocalist is doing. And it feels tremendously satisfying, and it fulfills my creative desires to just, you know, I'll pick a song by Paul Simon or Bruce Springsteen or learn it on piano, and just so I can accompany myself. It's not about performing. It's just jamming. I'm jamming with myself.
Yeah. You're fun. Hearing the song. You're taking your skills. You're trying to service the song as best you can, but like getting to play with it along the way and see what limitations you have.
And I don't feel there's any pressure on me to achieve something with that, or that it has to be of a certain
level. It's
like
sculpting or something, you know?
Yeah. And whatever the result is, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
It's not setting an expectation up. It's just enjoying it for what it is. And I find that even though I've been doing that now, it's been about 8 months since I started doing that, I can bring some of the lessons learned from that experience into my actual professional performances. That youthful spontaneity, that just sheer happiness that comes from that.
Yeah.
These translate into my performances behind the drum set.
No doubt.
They do.
For me, I kind of had the opposing experience, which is for me as a vocalist, having an opportunity 2 or 3 years ago with a band that I play with. Sometimes they'd hire out a trio version of the band. And in order to make this work financially, they wanted me to play the cajon rather than pay for the drummer to play the cajon. They're like, Jeff, why don't you just play the cajon too? Something I would never endeavor to do, certainly at the same time on a paid gig. In my mind, it's like I've been around the cajon. I love drums. I love percussion, but maybe casually sit on it but not really understand what I'm doing. And then thinking, okay, we're doing 80 songs next week. I guess I'm going to have to listen to them and figure out where the kick and the snare goes and just throw myself into it and do that juggling act of singing, but also, you know, basically trying to keep it as simple as possible and just faithfully get the basic kick snare. But then once I start to do it, develop some more appreciation for a little bit more confidence and subtlety. But like you're saying, more than anything, rather than feeling like, you know, I've become an accomplished percussionist, just a person who can appreciate what it is to play percussion well, because I've sat on that box and I've done the best that I can. But I can see and hear the difference when somebody is like living inside of it. And that was a good opportunity for me to have that new childlike curiosity about the music that was happening, which otherwise, you know, like if you'd sung a song 100 times, you can kind of just kind of, it becomes a little bit automatic, you know, but it induced presence when I was keeping time.
Sure. And it probably re-inspires your singing.
It did.
Well.
Yeah. It certainly affected the singing. Absolutely. In ways that I don't think I consciously realized at first, but retrospectively, I think I began to identify.
Yeah.
Todd, we've had a good conversation, and if you can believe it, we have run out of time.
I believe it.
You do? Okay, yeah. Good.
I keep time for a living,
Jeff. That's true, you do. You're the first drummer I've had in here, and there's a part of me that prides myself on the fact that the show flies by, but you keep good time. But you saw that I kept good time also when we were walking over here. We wondered what time it was, yeah. And I was 1 minute off.
You were.
You're the drummer, I'm the radio host. Together, we should find some sort of enterprise where we keep time together.
As long as there's no internet involved, it'll be fine.
Yeah, no internet. Well, think about time is as old as people keeping time. It's always been a thing. Since time immemorial, there has been time. So why don't we think about, we'll go off air, we're going to flesh out this concept of building an organization, which will be a super band, where there'll be a marketing person, graphic design, everybody will have their say in the band, but there'll be no web presence, and you and I will always be very aware of what time it is.
I'll finish with one other thought.
Please.
I was hoping one day to have a band that didn't have a band name either.
Just like untitled in just, parentheses on
well,
the poster?
You know, a band name is really just a marketing ploy, I guess.
I guess Prince had the logo.
I did get inspired by Prince and his logo, and I remember when he died, I remember watching an interview he gave where he tried to explain why he changed his name, and often it's cited just because of the record label and the contractual obligations.
Yeah.
But in that conversation that he had, I could sense his genuine desire to get away from the idea of having to represent himself with a name. I could sense the real feeling that he had there. It wasn't just a scam. I could feel it in his conversation.
So do we need to have an image, or could we even be...
You have to be able to transcend these things. I mean, music exists.
Because I'm just thinking about the poster. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, well...
But maybe there doesn't need to be a poster.
It's no poster. It already is out there, Jeff. It's already there.
You know, I like the fact that we're having this conversation as being archived, because in a theoretical scenario where this really takes off, we'll know the moment that it really took root, or at least I'll know the moment that I witnessed it taking root. And it was here at CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant. This has been Now We're Talking. Todd Bifford has been my guest. He's a percussionist. We've had an enjoyable conversation about that. And of course, you can go see him in Million Dollar Quartet, which is playing at the Arts Club at the Stanley Theater on Granville until July 9th. Thanks, Todd.
You're welcome.
Cheers.